It's time to talk to Tom Skilling, and boy, do we have a lot to talk to you about, Tom. Happy you're with us today. Tom Skilling, sponsored by PermaSeal Basement Systems. So we're
good
feeling.
Yeah, there is a lot to talk about since last we visited. Boy, it's been busy, Anna.
Yeah, you know, you're feeling for all those folks, homes lost but not lives, and that we can be thankful for. And, you know, what do you make now that you've been able to take a look at what happened that day? What do you think, Tom?
Well, it's stunning. You know, first of all, the time of the day it hit, 11 to 11:30 at night, is when the Twister went across Naperville, Woodridge, Darien, Burr Ridge, and Willow Springs. There's another one that went all the way from Plainfield, lifted in Romeoville, and they're investigating some other Doppler tracks. See, these Doppler radars give us an idea where there are circulations, and then when these post-storm surveys are done, and the forecasters and the survey team out of the National Weather Service know where to go to look for any signs of damage. And there are other indicated rotations, one of them from Hobart, Indiana, to South Haven over in Porter County in Indiana. So a lot going on. But that EF3, which went into Naperville, Woodridge, Darien, Burr Ridge, and Willow Springs, 130 homes seriously damaged, 9 injuries. And an EF3, Anna, produces winds of 136 to 165 miles per hour. That's the estimate. You know, Anna, what these survey people do is they go out and look at the damage done by these tornadoes, and then that offers clues on what the winds were. So, and of course, there are Doppler measurements of wind anymore, but they don't always get down to the near surface area because of the way the Earth curves under the radar beam. So it's wise to have ground truth and get surveyors out there to look at what's gone on. And, you know, to give you an idea of the rarity of a tornado, first of all, for it to happen nocturnally at night, 11 to 11:30, which are particularly frightening tornadoes, because they come out of the dark. You know, only 2% of tornadoes come into the EF2 or stronger range. June, as it turns out, is the big month for severe weather and tornadoes in Chicago. That's an interesting point that was driven home by my Weather Service colleagues. And this was the biggest tornado. The first EF2 or larger, and an EF2 tornado produces 111 to 135 mile per hour winds. The biggest tornado in 6 years around here since that infamous June 22nd, 2015 Coal City tornado, which did such damage. So, boy, it was something. And we wound up with rain out of that, too. And it looks like the week ahead is going to be an active one in the precipitation area. So, you know, if there's a silver lining to it, it's the fact we got some rain. Often it came down too heavily, but we needed it desperately. We're still way off the normal since March 1 and year to date. We've had only about 60% of our normal rain since March 1st, and precipitation has been only, actually 60% since the first of the year, 62% of our pond normal rain since March 1st. So it continues dry. But the rain did, for the moment, kind of alleviate some of the issues we were having with that, though it hasn't solved them completely. Now, we'll see what we get this week, Anna.
Yeah. Tom, a couple questions for you. You know, I've interviewed people throughout my career as a news reporter after tornadoes have moved through. And one of the most common things you hear people say, if they're right there in the center of the storm, is that it sounded like a freight train. We also heard in the Tribune, I was looking at their coverage, people said it sounded like boom, boom, boom. Another person said it sounded like a sonic boom. And I just wonder if you can kind of explain that, what you're hearing meteorologically, what we can attribute to that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you bring that up. We did a documentary right after the Plainfield tornado, and we entitled it, "It Sounded Like a Freight Train," because that's what you often hear from folks. And the fact is, Anna, any kind of strong wind will sound like a freight train. Even the straight line winds that are produced by a thunderstorm, they're equally damaging, just as tornadoes are. The only difference is one travels in a straight line, and the other one is a rotary circulation, and that's what occurs in tornadoes. Both can be equally devastating, but it's the roar of winds through trees and buildings and so forth that gives it that freight train sound. It's making contact, the wind is, with objects that inhibit its flow, and that produces a roar. The sonic boom is an interesting observation, and there could be a lot of reasons that was going on. You know, for one thing, you're taking out transformers and everything else with these storms, and there's some sound associated with that as well. But also, you've got treetops being blown off and branches coming down. There are a lot of things that can create a boom sound as debris is tossed through the air. One thing that struck me are the pictures out of these areas. Hmm. You've got homes, the sides of homes, that look like they've been machine gunned. And what it drives home when you see something like that, holes in walls, entire walls of homes, is the debris that is blowing around in these storms. And that's one of the uniquely devastating and potentially injurious and deadly aspects of a tornado. And that is these storms winds pick up all kinds of debris and they blow it in all these projectiles through the air. So when you got a tornado coming at you, you've got effectively what amounts to a wall of bullets coming at you or debris. And that's why we tell everybody, A, stay away from windows. And by the way, I was posed an interesting question by the mother of Brian Say, who's one of our producers on the morning show. And she said, what about the notion we used to hear about opening up windows in tornadoes? That's no longer effective. That's kind of mythology. It was once thought that equalized air pressure. But as a friend of mine said, who worked as a research associate with Dr. Ted Fujita at the University of Chicago, he used to say, don't worry about opening windows. The tornado will do it for you. And he makes an interesting point when you think about it. And that is, really, if there was such a pressure change, opening your windows, and believe me, the windows will blow out. And you're opening them or not. It makes no difference whatsoever. And in fact, any time you waste getting yourself to a safe place in a building, is just that. It's wasted. You shouldn't be opening windows. You should be getting into an interior room, or preferably down in a basement where you're protected from either the building collapsing on you or any projectiles. And if you're opening a window and it shatters and those shards of glass go airborne, they're deadly. You don't want to deal with that.
Hey, Tom, I want to ask you about something that really struck me, because you mentioned the 11 o'clock, 11:30 time frame. A lot of people were asleep. It's a Sunday night, and they attribute these early warning systems to the reasons why they were able to get to safety and seek shelter and do all the things you're talking about, get away from the windows. But we got to pause for a second. I want to ask you where we are today with our early warning systems, how far we've come, and then kind of where you think we're heading from here, what you'll be able to do one day maybe. Back with Tom Skilling here, sponsored by PermaSeal Basement Systems. Tom, before we pause there, hit the pause button to check traffic, I wanted to ask you about the early warning system. So many of the folks who escaped from this said, thank God I got that alert on my phone. I heard those sirens. It was enough time, even though I was dead asleep, to be able to seek shelter and get my family safe. That's a big deal, early warning systems.
Big deal. And hats off to the Weather Service folks who were on top of this, I mean, from start to finish, and got those warnings out early. But now, you know, our cell phones are used as a communication device, and they go off. So if we don't have the radio or the television on, your phone activates. And I know mine went off here on the north side of Chicago. So this is really quite a new development. You know, when that tornado hit Washington, Illinois, down by Peoria on a Sunday morning when people were in church, many of them got the warnings over their cell phones as they sat in pews in the church. And that was attributed with saving many lives because, you know, normally you wouldn't have a phone, or you certainly wouldn't have radio and TV playing in a church service. So, you know, this is great. And we get about, I'll tell you what's revolutionized the warning system. We get now an average of about 12 minutes lead time. That's the average. Times is far more than that. But that's largely the result of these Doppler radars that the Weather Service put in and uses to put out the warnings. These are really sophisticated systems. They were developed over decades Much of the work went on down at the University of Oklahoma and the National Severe Storms Lab in Oklahoma. But these really have, you know, we didn't have the Doppler radar in when Plainfield was hit. We had a Doppler add-on on the Marseilles radar at the time, but it really wasn't a true Doppler radar. That went in about a year and a half after Plainfield struck. And it has revolutionized our ability to get the warnings out. And I'll tell you, there are further improvements coming, because what's happening now, the warning system of the future will marry not only radar, Doppler radar scans of the storms, but also computer models that get down to storm scale. In other words, there'll be models, and they're working on them now, that will actually predict a tornado evolving from a developing thunderstorm before the thunderstorm's even there. And we're not quite there yet, but they're getting higher and higher resolution models. And so it's conceivable that we might get an hour or more advance warning at some point down the road when we combine not only radar observations, but with, you know, numerical modeling to the whole proposition as well, Anna. So interesting things on the horizon.
For sure. One of the things I was watching were the debris fields that were showing up on the radar as well, and those seemed pretty significant to see. They said that 10,000 feet in the air, they were monitoring, I guess, projectiles and debris that was already forming in some of the areas.
Yeah, no question. You know, these tornadoes hoist huge amounts of debris into the air. And if you've got a particularly strong tornado, you can actually see the debris on the radar. And it produces a very distinct signature, which enables forecasters to know that, wow, for that debris to be up there, there has to be one heck of a tornado. Also, you look at the velocity fields that come out of these radars, and that's how a Doppler radar is different than the normal conventional radar. Conventional radar sends out pings of energy that bounce off raindrops and snowflakes and come back and tell you where it's raining and snowing, how heavily. But Doppler looks at frequency shifts in the moving particles, and in so doing, it can calculate the wind speed inside thunderstorms. And so we actually see the workings of the wind field. And you don't often see the tornado specifically itself. What you see is what's called a mesocyclone. That's the rotating supercellular thunderstorm that is a proxy indicator that you probably or very likely have a tornado in a particular area. So when forecasters see these circulations, they can put out a warning in advance of them because they know what direction these storms are moving, and can warn in advance that there may in fact be a tornado on the ground and moving. And then of course we have spotters all over the area who play an incredibly important role and give forecasters ground truth on what's going on. And that's particularly true at night, although it's very hard at night even for our spotters to see these storms, because oftentimes you depend on the lightning to illuminate the funnel cloud. It's so dark. And those are really frightening storms because people, as you say, Anna, are in bed. And, you know, that's a terrible time to have a tornado roll through.
Hey, Tom, will you settle something for me that almost caused marital problems the other night? I'm driving back from a barbecue late. We stayed a little later than we should have. And so we're driving back, kind of got making our way back into the city. My phone goes off. You said your phone went off right in the city. And it's tornado warning, seek shelter. And I say to my husband, we better hurry up and get home. And he says, don't worry, they never hit the city. And I thought, I'm going to ask Tom about that.
Oh, no. I'll tell you, heck. You know, I'm up here on the north side in the Edgewater neighborhood. We had a tornado touchdown right on the campus of Loyola on the lakeshore here. The tornado in 67, the Oak Lawn tornado. That thing went across Oak Lawn, went across the Dan Ryan Expressway, went across Evergreen Park and the south end of Chicago. It wound up, having gone across all that terrain in the city, it ended up a mile out over the lake east of the Science and Industry Museum before it dissipated. Tornadoes can and do happen in the city, and that's a myth that we can't seem to, you know, to break. I don't know why that still floats around, but what is true, Anna, is that I remember Ted Fujita, the tornado researcher I mentioned to so often, down at the University of Chicago, he had a little tornado machine in his lab, and he explained that he felt the heat produced by a city could take a weak tornado down maybe one F-scale intensity. And he would prove it by, he developed one of these tornadoes in his laboratory, in his little machine there, down on the University of Chicago campus. And then he had this grid of wires that he could plug in and would heat up and turn red hot, simulating the heat of the city. Mm-hmm. And he'd have this perfectly formed vortex in his little machine. And the minute he turned the heat on, this thing would become kind of disoriented and break up and everything else. And he used that to simulate the effect of heat on some weak tornadoes. But the right tornado, or the wrong, depending on how you look at it, is going to, first of all, the buildings are no deterrent because the circulation of a tornado reaches far beyond the top of any skyscraper. It can go up 40, 50,000 feet into a thunderstorm. So, you know, a Hancock building or a Willis Tower or a Trump Tower, any of these, these buildings are only the barest few thousand, hundred feet in the lower part of the atmosphere. They don't disrupt the tornado circulation. But tornadoes can, and they do happen in the city, and we have history to prove it.
Yeah. Heed the warnings, then. I just want to say, hey, we're out of time here, Tom. I could talk to you forever about it. And I just want to thank you and the meteorologists in town and the National Weather Service folks. Moments like that, do we appreciate you. We really do. Wow.
Well, thanks. I'll tell you, I can't say enough for my Weather Service colleagues. They did a marvelous job on this storm. And they're so important in surveying the aftermath and telling us what actually happened and quantifying the effects. Thanks, Anna. That's very nice of you.
Good talking with you, Tom.
Good to talk to you.
Tom Skilling, sponsored by PermaSeal Basement Systems. Time for the news at the top of the hour from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Tom, just to check on you, I want to make sure I got it right. You said something, only certain percentage of EF3s are stronger for tornadoes.
EF2s are stronger. You're right, Anna. The figure I see is 2%. 2%. And you know, it's
Tom, 2% are EF2s are stronger or EF3s are stronger?
EF2s are stronger, Anna.
Wow.
Yeah. And the difference, EF2 is 111 to 135 miles per hour. 111 to 135 for an EF2. EF3 goes 136 to 165. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you go even higher. You go up to EF5s. And the top wind speed, which has been measured in a tornado, is 318 miles per hour. And by the way, that's interesting. That's been Doppler measured. But Ted Fujita developed, you know, we used to think tornadoes had 1,000-mile-an-hour winds. But Ted Fujita, in looking at video or tapes, films that had emerged, he'd take each frame of an 8-millimeter movie of a tornado, and he would track debris he saw on each frame and use that to infer the wind speeds. And he calculated that based on that, before we had Doppler radar scans of these storms, he speculated the top wind speed would be in the range of 310, 320 miles an hour. So it turned out his calculations were very accurate. And, you know, that's even before we had Doppler measurements of it. So that's kind of interesting.
Now, is he still with us, Ted Fujita? Is he?
No.
Long gone.
Mm-hmm. You know, he was amazing. We had him out to Fermilab to our seminars. And what a fascinating guy. He was one of the five young Japanese scientists that were called into Hiroshima and Nagasaki to figure out by the Japanese government to figure out what had gone on. And he talks about that, and he became quite intrigued with the vortices he saw that had twisted debris because of the tremendous heat of these bombs going off around the periphery of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And he later became very interested. He wrote a paper that caught the eye of the University of Chicago department head on thunderstorms over Mount Fuji. And, in fact, he sent the paper to the University of Chicago, and by God, they brought him over here and offered him a job. And the rest is history. You know, he revolutionized our thought. He's the guy who coined the term downburst and microburst. And he was told by his colleagues he was nuts and that such a thing didn't exist. And he, too, deep into adulthood, he was so injured by that because, you know, this research community, they're a brutal bunch. They go after one another, which is why it's good. It's part of the scientific method. I mean, you know, you put a theory ahead or forward, you damn well better be able to prove it. And you better get other people in your profession on board. And when Fujita first proposed the notion there were downbursts and microbursts. He did it investigating an Eastern Airlines plane crash out at JFK that had killed hundreds. And they told him, you know, people said he's nuts, he's crazy. And that really wounded him. It's something he remembered and would refer to in my discussions with him late into life. And and now everybody accepts the fact that he was right on. He absolutely had the whole thing nailed.
How about that, Tom? What an interesting story. I mean, my God, that hopefully that is chronicled in multiple documentaries, because I'd like to see them.
You know what, Anna, if you ever get a chance, American Experience on PBS did a program on Fujita, Mr. Tornado. That's what he called himself. In fact, he'd do studies, and he would pay to print them because he wanted to be sure they were done to his specs. And so he didn't want anybody else publishing his papers. So he would take the money he got researching plane crashes like the Eastern Airlines crash, and he would plunk it back into the printing and all of his papers. And some in the profession resented that because they felt you should go through a peer review process, and they felt he was sidestepping that. But the fact of the matter is, the guy was brilliant. He was, scientists like that, they travel in some respects to the beat of a different drummer. But thank God we've got like that in this world, who can look at what seems like chaos, the aftermath of a tornado strike, and see order in the whole thing. And he also was the one who began the overflight of tornado-struck areas to understand the damage patterns. And he found patterns in cornfields that indicated that tornadoes were often made of not one funnel, but they had multiple vortices circulating within them. And they would carve out swirls in cornfields, laying down the fact that, you know, you had a multiple vortex tornado, not a single vortex. So the guy was amazing. Huh. And of course, the index we used to categorize the intensities, the Fujita scale, was his invention.
Yeah. It's fascinating stuff, Tom. Thanks for taking a little extra time with me, and appreciate you always. Really do.
And good to talk to you. I tell you, you take care.
You too, Tom. We'll talk soon, okay? Thanks. Next Tuesday.
You bet. Bye, Anna.